Do you have a question about your money? On Your Money's, Kevin McKinley is here with some answers. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, July 17th. On today's edition of On Your Money, some insight on the cost of raising a child, a few things to consider before buying a tablet PC, and Roth IRAs versus Roth 401ks. Plus, the money question that might be on your mind today. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
So, one more hot day. You ready for it?
As long as you promise this is the last one for 2012, yes, I think I can handle it.
Well, I'll do what I can. I think we still have more hot weather coming this weekend, but we just have to live through it, I guess. So, Kevin, I just noticed that there are some new numbers out on the cost of raising a child today, and boy, this might give a pause to some prospective parents.
Yeah, this is really one of the most effective forms of birth control and population control for rational, thinking, frugal people. The Department of Agriculture releases these numbers every single year. I don't know why it's the Department of Agriculture. You'd think, if anything, they would want to promote population growth, more people eating food, but they release these numbers, and it quite frankly scares the heck out of prospective parents. They said that to raise a child from birth to 18... For a middle-income family, it is going to cost about $235,000. In other words, almost $250,000 for a middle-income family from birth to 18. Lower-income family will probably spend about $170,000, and an upper-income family will spend close to $400,000.
Holy schmoly.
That's right. And it doesn't include the lost income if there's a stay-at-home parent. And a lot of people are saying, well, yeah, once you throw college in there, I could see that number. That figure does not include the cost of college either.
Well, what frightening figures does this entail?
Well, the current estimates, according to the College Board, a public in-state school right now costs about $21,000 per year from start to finish. An out-of-state public school is about $34,000. And a private school is averaging about $42,000. Now, if you multiply those numbers by four, you have a much greater hope for your average kid getting in and out of college in 4 years. But then you throw 4% inflation on that 18 years from now. Let's just say you really don't want to know what those actual numbers equal.
I don't know how my parents did it, but again, that was way back in the day. So any positive information from these reports?
Sure. We should take this in context. Now, this is over 18 years, so this $250,000 works out to about $1,000 per month, and that includes a lot of things like food and transportation. And the largest portion of the cost is housing cost, which the Department of Agriculture typically uses a bedroom per kid. And in theory, anyway, once you have that bedroom in the house and then you sell the house, you'll get a payback on that investment at some point, too. Also, even when it comes to the cost of college, the hope is that maybe the delivery of a higher education becomes more efficient. Maybe we have more online classes that don't require 4 or 5 years away. And at least for people who are concerned in listening to this, if you are still thinking about having a child, you definitely live in the right state and region to raise kids as cost efficiently as possible.
That's how they did it. We had three girls and three boys in the two bedrooms.
So. Were you on Brady Bunch?
Yeah, we could have been.
Oh, I thought that was yeah. All right.
Except we're not a blended family. How is it different in different states and regions?
Well, in Wisconsin in the upper Midwest, we have a relatively low cost of living and a high quality of life. We also have very safe, affordable housing. The median home price in Wisconsin typically is about 90% that of the rest of the United States. We have very good public schools, and even the private schools are fairly inexpensive. A lot of places in metropolitan areas and on the coast, private schools are the only option for many families, and they can run easily $20,000 to $25,000 per year. We also have a very good in-state college system set up, and we have relatively frugal community values. Bundle.com tracked what parents across the country spend on their kids in various stores that cater to parents. and then found that the average spenders were typically in places like Nashville and Cincinnati. The real high spenders were in places like Manhattan and Brooklyn. The very low places, though, Milwaukee was 54% lower than average, St. Paul was 56% lower than average, and Madison was the lowest metropolitan area they ranked at 58% lower than what the typical parents spent in these various stores.
And our kids are all above average.
They are all above average, and let me just say something. I got some good advice from someone a long time ago, and my kids are thankful for this advice. If you wait until it's the right time to have kids, you will never have kids. So it is the dumbest financial move you can possibly make, but it's still generally a good idea.
Could save you on that long-term insurance, though, Kevin.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that. So I'm hoping my kids will be around there. Look, but most of us live to 85 or 95. Our kids are going to be 65 or 75 by the time we kick the bucket. So hoping that they'll be around to take care of us. This is not 100 years ago. This is not rural America. This is a new day and age.
That's right. Kevin McKinley, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for everyone. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it is time now for the On Your Money email bag. And Susie says, it's good to have you both back together again. Love your show. Shameless compliment intended. LOL. That's good. Our very last house payment, she says, is tomorrow. My husband is worried about not having the tax deduction. How badly will this impact our taxes? Kevin?
First of all, Susie, we are taking your question just barely, though. You did say, love your show, but you didn't make the full commitment by saying, I love your show. We'll let it go this time because this is a very important time in your life.
Yes.
It's really not going to be that big of a deal, at least not for Susie and her husband, in part because when you have a very low mortgage balance, you have a very low dollar interest, even if it's just, you know, $20,000 a year or so and you're paying 5%, that's only about $1,000 of interest per year. And even if it is deductible, if you're in the 25% overall tax bracket, let's say, it might save you about $250 in taxes or so. So it's really these last few payments haven't been saving them much in taxes in terms of the interest.
But don't people who owe more on their mortgages pay more in interest and therefore get a bigger deduction?
That's true, but they still have to itemize first. And the standard deduction right now for 2012 is almost $12,000 for a married couple filing jointly and about half that for single. So you can use other, you know, potentially deductible expenses like property taxes to do it. But still, because of this much higher amount and because most people typically have mortgages that are in the $100,000 to $200,000 range, they're generally going to have a hard time building up enough deductions to itemize. If they have higher mortgages, yeah, it's nice to have it, but if they don't, they probably are better off just using the standard deduction.
So how can we use the tax breaks on mortgage interest to our best advantage?
Some people have been sold on this notion that, you know, you should have a mortgage because you get the tax break on it. I think it's one extra benefit of having a mortgage, but I'd much rather have people focus on getting a very long-term loan at a fixed rate that is at a very low, historically low interest. And for the time being, you can get a very high loan-to-value for homes. And whether it's, you know, the term, the fixed rate, the low rates, the high loan-to-value, or even the tax deduction, some or all of that could not exist in the future. So if you've been thinking about getting a new mortgage, now's the time to do it.
What are some specific moves that we could make with those mortgage proceeds?
One thing I'd like to see if people are still working is definitely increase your pre-tax retirement savings like through your 401k or 403b or TSA. For most people, every dollar you get into that will save you about 20 to 30 cents on next year's tax bill. You also might want to pay off some higher interest debt like credit card loan or student loans or car loans. or you could just keep the proceeds safe for any future uses that you might have. You know, if rates go up in the future, or if it's harder to borrow for whatever reason, you'll be very, very glad you tapped that equity when you did. On that note, though, if you are concerned that you'll spend that money instead of just tucking it aside, then it's probably better off just to continue paying your mortgage as the current schedule allows.
All right, Susie, thanks for the email and the shameless compliment, and good luck to you. We have a caller who has a mortgage-related question, so let me go to Mike in Coon Valley first. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Hi, Kevin and Joy. You both answered every question I had, but I just wanted to touch on it again. Our tax preparer says never pay off mortgage. Borrow against the house to do stuff, buy a new car, or take your vacation. And the financial advisor says, you know, pay off that mortgage, invest in other areas. So it sounds like it's kind of best to pay off the mortgage. But then, when, you know, we got a little ways to go before we're going to be in that position. But if we were to start adding to our IRAs, which we haven't been able to do too much in the past couple of years, would that offset any savings we see in our mortgage interest deduction on our taxes?
Well, if you do an IRA, especially if it's tax deductible, you'll get way more savings by putting money into those, by and large, than you will by retiring the debt. Let's say you've got $10,000 extra and you have a mortgage that's 5%. Well, it's going to cost you $500 in interest this year. But if you are in the overall 20 or 30% tax bracket and you were to put that $10,000 into a pre-tax plan like a 401k or an IRA or a 403b or a TSA, you'll save $2,000 to $3,000 on your income tax bill next year. Now, at some point, you're probably going to have to pay taxes on that money, perhaps when you pull it out in retirement. But usually, you're better off paying off the mortgage as slowly as possible and saving money for retirement. It's a very tough situation for people to be in when they're on the cusp of retirement. They don't have enough liquid money, but they have a paid-for home, because if something comes up and they need to bridge their expenses from earning to Social Security or a pension, sometimes if their biggest asset is a paid-for home, it's very difficult to tap that.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Mike. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you have a question that you would like Kevin to tackle. And John in Schofield has a question. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I want to get Kevin's opinion on vehicle purchases. We've always driven them into the ground. Right now I have a 97 Ford pickup with 192,000 miles on. It may die today. For all I know, it might have died last night. But anyway, and we've always bought vehicles that are a year or two old, used, in good condition. And what do you think? You should buy a new vehicle every couple of years, or should you drive them to the end of the ground? Just what's your opinion, Kevin?
Well, it's a great question, John. And again, one of the reasons I love living and working in Wisconsin and being on Wisconsin Public Radio is generally people do not brag about how nice their car is. They brag about how many miles are on the odometer. So thank you for reaffirming that, John. Usually, for most people, it's better to drive it into the ground, just because depreciation is the biggest expense of owning a vehicle. And the less the value is, if it drops maybe, you know, 15 to 20% per year, obviously the dollar loss on a low-cost vehicle is a lot lower than it is on a high-cost vehicle. However, for a couple of reasons, newer or new cars are still something you might want to look at. The first one being is a lot of people, all they can afford right now is a used car. Therefore, and this is less true now than it was maybe a year ago, but still there's kind of an imbalance between new car pricing and used car pricing. And when I say that, people accuse me of, you know, having some kind of secret sponsorship from car dealerships something. Car dealerships actually make more money on used cars than they do selling you a new car generally, especially as a percentage of the price. So if you really want to get a good deal from the dealer, you're probably getting a better deal with a new car. Second thing is you can get a much better loan, which I think most people should get car loans with a new car than they can with a used car. You can get a longer term and a lower interest rate. And the third thing is that if people are kind of living hand-to-mouth and they really don't have a ton of money set aside, a new car is much more predictable. Yes, you're going to have a high payment, whether it's, you know, a lease payment or loan payment, but that's usually all you're going to have. Whereas if you're driving a very low-cost used car and you need it to get to work or pick up the kids from school or whatever, you never quite know if there's going to be something around the corner that's not only going to cost you $500 to $5,000, but also put you out of a vehicle for the time being while it's getting fixed, and then maybe have to buy a replacement vehicle in a hurry, which usually means if you're buying it in a hurry, you're not getting a very good deal. So if you're just frugal, you've got lots of extra savings set aside, you can handle a breakdown, you don't need the vehicle every day, you have a backup vehicle, let's say, yeah, the used cars are still usually the better way to go. But for people with good credit and not much else in the way of assets, sometimes a new car is a better deal.
Would it be, I haven't quite decided, a used or new one yet, but either one, I would be able to pay for it. Is that a smart thing to do?
Typically, with the interest rates as low as they are, if you have more than enough money sitting around, you just say, I've got, you know, $50,000 or $100,000 sitting in my liquid savings, earning nothing, I might as well save 2 or 3% interest that it would cost for a loan. But if you are buying a new car, sometimes not only will they have special terms on financing, like 0% interest, but they won't give you a dollar discount if you pay cash. So usually in that case, you might say, you know what, I'm just going to get the loan, make the payment, and hopefully not spend the money on something I'll regret otherwise.
Okay, thanks, Todd. I'm going to see if that 15-year-old truck starts.
All right, good luck, John.
Thank
you. Sounds good. Thanks very much for the call. From wanting to buy a new or used car to someone who's having some problems related to a car. Audrey in Milwaukee. Hello, Audrey.
Yes, hello. My question is in regards to having a car repossessed. This is for a 30-year-old who has an income of about $26,000. He owes more than it's worth, about $10,000, and it was repossessed. Is it advisable to go ahead and declare bankruptcy?
I'm taking this, guessing this car owner, former car owner, is related to you, Audrey?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, this is part of the expense of having children, I'm guessing?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, yeah, all right. Again, once my kids are all past your kids' age and haven't gone through anything like this, I'll tell you exactly how to handle it. But until that point, I'm not sure I have a whole lot of answers on how to avoid this. The bankruptcy issue is probably not the best idea at this point, just because a repossessed car is not good. But it's not the end of the world. It's one default, which is better off than going through the whole bankruptcy process. Are there several other debts that you know of besides this that
about $12,000 in student loans, which I know is not going to be, let go.
Yep. If that's the case, then you probably aren't going to gain a whole lot by doing it, but it will stick on his credit for a long time. And what will really be a big issue going forward is if he applies for some kind of job where an adverse credit history can cause some problems for him. So, again, the repossession of the car isn't a great idea. The bankruptcy is probably the last thing that I would do at this point, especially if that's the only major debt that he has. You're exactly right. The student loans are usually not dischargeable in bankruptcy for good reason. So it's a tough situation, but hopefully this will be the biggest money mistake he ever makes.
Okay. Yeah, well, it seems, though, as far as enabling, this has been kind of a pattern leading up to it. Poor choices. So
yeah, it is, and I'll tell you what, Audrey, you sound like a very bright person, and you obviously are since you listen to this show.
Mm-hmm.
I know people a lot smarter than you who have just bewilderedly. This is your son, right?
Yes.
Yeah, how old is he?
30.
Okay. I know people a lot smarter than you and me who sit there and look at their kids at 30 or 40. You do the best you can But they just say, you know, and especially comparing them to some siblings, you say, what did we do differently with this one and versus that one? You do the best you can, but that's really all you can do. And if you, you know, sometimes, like you say, the enabling can actually hurt them down the road. And at this point, it's probably better off to say, hey, you're on your own. You got to figure this out and see what he can do.
Good luck to you, Audrey. Thank you very much for the call. Margaret in Crystal Lake is with us now. Hello, Margaret.
Hello. Hi. Good morning, Kevin.
Hi.
Smartest man in the world. I bought a house a few years ago, and when I bought it, the upstairs was already rented, and that renter has continued, and I lived on the, in the downstairs. And since that time, I've moved, and the downstairs has sometimes been rented and sometimes not. At any rate, I'm wondering if I go for a smaller mortgage interest rate, it's at 6% now, if I'm going to have trouble because it's not owner-occupied.
So what you want to do is you want to refinance this rental property that you own, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I would be surprised, unless you have, again, some kind of adverse credit situation.
No.
And if you get an answer like that where they say, you know what, no offense, lady, but 6% is better than we'd give you, might as well stick with what you have, I'd go someplace else and shop around, because lenders, that you know, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed person sitting at the desk at the credit union or the bank, they only get paid if the loan is actually made. And so they have a financial incentive to give you the loan. Obviously, if your numbers go in their software and it doesn't spit out an approval, it's a lot tougher to get. But with the way rental property is right now and the way the housing market is in general and the way lenders are, I think it's probably the best time in the last couple of years anyway to try to go back and refinance. So I'd definitely do it and wait to see what the lender says first. And again, even if they say, nah, I don't think so, or no, you have to come up with more equity, I would get it. I would get it for as much as they would allow. And if you can get where I think you'll get caught is probably they might not do a fixed rate, or they won't do a fixed rate for 30 years. They might just do an adjustable rate, like an ARM for where it's fixed for 5 years and then moves to an adjustable. Or they might give you a fixed rate but only do it for 20 years. But don't, you know, look around locally, and if you don't find anything, like, try some of the national ones, like, you know, the only one I can think of offhand is Quicken, but there's a lot of them out there. If you put the word loan into real estate loan into Google, you'll find 10 different ads on the right-hand side of the page that you can click on and see what they say.
All right. So I'm not going to get a different rate for rental than I did for ownership then?
You might, but they can't take the one away from you.
Okay.
I mean, unless they have that rate predicated on you being in there and find out during the process that you're not, I suppose there's some scenario like that where that could happen. But otherwise, no. The worst thing you do is you'll end up with the same loan that you currently have.
Thanks very much, Margaret, for the call. Good luck to you. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley, and it's time now for Smart Assets. And Kevin, on this program, we have touted the many virtues of the Roth IRA, but what about the Roth 401k or the Roth 403b or the Roth 457? Do they have many virtues too?
Yeah, they sound like not just retirement savings vehicle, but also powerful handguns.
Yes,
well,
they do.
Yeah, I'm carrying a Roth 57 right now. Yeah, we're seeing a lot of these with people who bring their stuff into the office is where they have these at-work Roth plans, and they like the idea of getting a tax break in the future on pulling this money out. But typically, it's not the best way to go. The Roth IRA, you have to have earned income to make a contribution to it, and the contribution limits are the lesser of $5,000 or $6,000 if you're over 50, or your income, whichever is less. You do not get a tax break when you put the money in the Roth IRA, but in theory, the money you pull out in retirement from the Roth IRA is tax-free, and distributions will not affect Social Security payments in terms of taxability under today's laws. Best of all, for people who are on a tight budget, Roth IRA contributions can be pulled back out at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever.
Well, so how does an at-work Roth retirement plan differ?
There are some benefits to these Roth 401ks, et cetera. First of all, there's no income eligibility restrictions like there is with a traditional Roth IRA. Second, you can definitely contribute more money, about $17,000 or your earnings, whichever is less, or up to $22,500 if you're over 50. Some people like the notion of having a payroll deduction rather than having to scramble and make a Roth IRA deposit by tax time every year. You can also make Roth 401k contributions and get a potential match from your employer, but that does go into a separate taxable account. Finally, if you do just build up money in a Roth 401k or the others and then you retire, you can convert it to a Roth IRA and there's no taxes for it. And maybe best of all for people down the road, unlike IRAs and traditional 401ks and 403bs, Roth versions of these have no mandatory distribution at 70 and a half. So no taxes on it in retirement, and you also aren't going to be forced to take it out while you're alive.
So do you favor one over the other?
For most people, I typically like the Roth IRA. You should only use the Roth at-work plan, like the 401k or 403b, Roth 403b, if you're in a year with abnormally low income and you expect to be taxed at a higher rate in retirement than you are when you're making that contribution into the Roth 401k or 403b. And typically that will come from a high pension or a high Social Security payment. But typically you're better off getting the deduction from a regular tax-deductible 401k or 403b and then at a certain point switching to a Roth IRA during the year.
So how can workers determine when to make this switch between a regular retirement savings plan at work and a Roth IRA?
For most middle-income people, it's determined by when they get out of the 25% federal tax bracket and down into the 15% federal tax bracket. That's typically put on line 43 of your tax form. It's $70,700 for married couples filing jointly and about half that for singles. Typically, you want to contribute enough to get down to that level at your pre-tax plan, then switch over to a Roth IRA until you've maxed out that contribution, and then if you still have room left over, then go back to your at-work plan and get a little bit more of a tax deduction.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money, and our next caller is Larry in Madison. Hi, Larry.
Thank you. I'm interested in a money market deposit account and wondering if it is insured by the FDIC. I know certificates of deposit are, and it seems that the money market deposit accounts pay more interest than a CD. I'm wondering, given that the more interest you get, general rule is there's more risk, how the money market deposit account would compare with a CD.
That's a great question, Larry, especially in these low interest rate times, in part because running a money market costs money to the provider, typically about 0.5% or so. Well, right now, the 10-year United States Treasury pays about 1.5%. So to keep a money market running, you have to have very safe, very liquid investments within that. Therefore, you're not going to make very much money. Most money market providers do not even make enough on their investments to cover their cost of doing business, much less pay some kind of interest to the depositors like you. So typically what people run into is, you know, they're not really sure what's in their money market account, and so I would definitely want you to use one that had FDIC insurance, especially if you are have a significant amount of money in there and are not going to be using it for quite a while. A better bet, Larry, might be to actually use a CD because you know exactly what that is. You probably are going to get a better long-term rate of return on that. And if you find one that pays you, you know, you're only going to get 1% or 2% on that. But typically, if you establish in advance what the substantial penalty for early withdrawal is, it's usually only about 6 to 12 months worth of interest. So you might be better off locking up a long-term CD and then knowing that your downside is limited if you need to pull it out, and you'll get a better yield, plus you'll get FDIC insurance.
Do all money market deposit accounts have FDIC insurance?
No, they do not. And FDIC is at the banks, and the NCUA insurance is better as the credit union version of this. They're equally good, but not all of them do have it. So if you are going to look at one, you probably want to try to find one that has FDIC insurance. And I'd much rather have you focus on having that safety and liquidity rather than trying to stick your neck out a little bit and get a little more yield, because it's just, even for the amount of risk you have to take to get a half a percent, it usually isn't going to be worth it.
Thank you, Larry. Great question. Dan in Appleton has been waiting. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great, how are you?
I'm a little warm. I'm sitting in the parking lot waiting to talk to you.
Oh.
No.
Sorry.
Either I die in a car accident or I die of heat stroke. What's the difference? I have a 11-year-old daughter, and we've saved up all her change, all her money. She had a rummage sale. We put $800 in the bank last month. Got all excited, got our first statement, and she had a 20% return on her money.
Holy cow.
Very disappointed. So, and I guess my biggest question is, I know there's no return on, you know, in a savings account, but how do you convince your children that this is a good thing to put money in the bank right now? I mean, she basically said, I can find that change in the couch seats and put it in my bank and come out ahead versus having it in a piggy bank versus having it in a real bank. How do we overcome that to convince our children that we have to continue to save because eventually this will go up?
Yeah, what I would say, well, first of all, congratulations. Second of all, you can point out to her, under the philosophy of finding money in the couch seat being return on your investment, that's like robbing the bank because it's not her money. So,
it's her dad.
Right.
But I would say, no, I would, one thing I would do that I found to be successful with kids is when you can get them to put their own money into an account, or you're trying to get them to do it, is do what many employers do when they're trying to get their employees to contribute to a 401k, and that's match the deposits. They're not going to make much in interest, and they could lose it if they put it in something that's more aggressive, like a stock mutual fund. But you might want to say to her, hey, for every dollar you get in here, I'll give you a dime. And so if you get $100 in, I'll get you $10. And that's a great way to foster savings and squirreling things aside, and also to kind of free up the money to know that this isn't just something. You know, kids have a very difficult time thinking about 20 or 30 years down the road. So tell her that for set up a system where every dollar that she gets to save a quarter, and she can give away a quarter, and then she can spend 50 cents or some ratio like that, so she can get excited about saving a little bit, spending a little, and then also get some kind of philosophical streak of giving and philanthropy going, which when's the next WPR Pledge Drive, Joy?
I think it is.
Just as something so you can kind of say, this is how we make decisions about money when we have control over it. As we spend a little, we save a little, and we hopefully are able to give away a little at the same time.
Thank you.
All right, Dan, and thanks for waiting in your hot car.
Yeah, I hope he didn't call last week. He's been sitting there the whole time.
Thanks a lot, Dan, for the call. If you have a question for Kevin, we won't make you wait in your hot car. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with Certified Financial Planner Kevin McKinley on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
What I really need is a computer. How about that one?
Mm-hmm. That technology is 3 months old. Only suckers buy out-of-date machines. Hey, you're not a sucker, are you, sir?
Heavens, no!
Oh, good. Because if you were, I'd have to ask you to leave the store.
I just need something to receive email.
You'll need a top-of-the-line machine for that.
That's Homer Simpson shopping around for a new computer. This is our Shop Around segment, and we've talked about tablet PCs before, Kevin, but some new developments motivated us to touch on the subject again. What's new?
Touch on the subject of tablet PCs. Joy, if this kind of humor doesn't get us a Peabody Award this year, it's never going to.
I guess it's never going to.
That's probably a safer bet. It's a very rapidly growing market worldwide. The tablet PC sales, according to the Gartner Group, are going to be 120 million units this year. That's twice as many as were sold in 2011. The iPad still dominates that market, usually depending on when the models are released, but it has about 60 to 70% of the market. Here in the U.S., Amazon Kindle and Fire are a very distant second, and there are some other ones entering the group. Samsung is one that's been around for a little while. It's a decent one, but the big players in the tech field are starting to pay attention to tablets, and it looks like they're going to have some offerings that might be worth considering.
Yeah, so what are some of these new offerings?
Google has just come out with their Nexus 7 after the 7-inch size. It's a little smaller than the traditional iPad, closer to the Kindle, but it's priced at $199, which is about $300 less than the basic iPad. Microsoft is also coming out with something called the Surface, which is like a very, very minimal laptop. They have a keyboard that's actually in the cover now. That's probably going to have iPad prices on it. Facebook is the other big player in this, but they're more interested in just having their experience work on the phones and tablets rather than trying to come up with their own device themselves, and it's probably just as well based on their success so far.
So are Apple and Amazon doing anything to counteract this competition?
No, they're sitting idly by saying, well, that was fun. Now what should we do?
Yeah, really.
You
What's
know,
new?
Later on this year, Apple's coming out with a 7-inch tablet itself and will be quite a bit cheaper, and also an attempt to compete with the Kindle and some of these smaller tablets. And then Amazon is parrying by coming out with a larger Kindle, 10 inches, more like the iPad, and also more expensive as well.
So should I think about buying a new tablet PC?
You might want to. They are fantastic. If you're worried you're not spending enough screen time, not talking to your friends and family members, this is a great way to make sure that you completely avoid them any way other than online.
But, there we go.
It could be even a little bit better in the next few months. You know, next month we're back to school shopping, and a lot of people feel like their kids will be paralyzed educationally if they don't have this kind of technology. But then after October or so, holiday shopping season starts. And even if you say, well, I want one of these, but I really don't want to spend $500 or $600, all the people who bought these things right now or in the last 6 months, they're going to be selling them so they can get the latest and greatest new version. So you will be able to buy used and refurbished models for a very low price. So you might want to keep an eye on that.
Sounds good. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And Kevin, if we don't get to everyone's question this week, we will devote the entire hour to your questions next week.
Yes, we are. The On Your Money email bag is filling up. Mm. And I mean that literally. We print off all the emails and put them in a sack. So what we're going to do next week is we're going to devote the entire hour to answering your questions, ones you send in via email to onyourmoney@wpr.org, or you'll be able to call in during the hour as well, and we'll try to take your question and call at that time, too.
Yep, we'll be busy as we are now. Jim in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Jim.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I really love this show, and I love WPR. Thanks for the service.
Well, thank you for calling. Great way to start the question, Jim.
I'm wondering, I just got married, and along with a lot of other great things, my wife brought some debt. And I'm wondering, when is it best to just pay off the debt, or when is it best just to pay off over time? It's a credit card debt. It's about $6,000 at 5%. And I'm very comfortable paying it off at $500 a month, or do I just suck it up now and pay it off and move on?
Jim, well, first of all, congratulations mm-hmm. on your marriage. And second of all, by the subtle tone in your voice when you mentioned your wife's debt, you're already at, like, a long-term married level of discussing your mate's mm-hmm. idiosyncrasies. So good for you. You're advancing past that to the point where a lot of us are with our partners and vice versa. I would have you do it slower, especially at that interest rate. If it were 19-29%, which we see on some of these credit cards, I would pay it off as quickly as possible. But 5% is not bad, and especially if you say, hey, there's other things I'd rather be doing with this money, saving for retirement, et cetera, I'd pay it off slower. And if for anybody out there, this may not be the case with you, Jim, but for people out there who have a partner, and a lot of people have a partner, typically spenders and savers are attracted to each other, that's good if, as a couple, they're stronger than they would be apart because they complement each other, but it's bad because money is a very quantifiable thing to have disagreements over. So if you're in this case, sometimes paying this off and leaving the available credit open is almost the worst thing you can do if the person is a spender, because it leaves a lot of room to start charging up in there. So if anybody out there is suffering from this with a partner, sometimes leaving that debt in there, the interest costs money, it hurts your credit, but it also means that they can't charge any more above and beyond what they have. Mm-hmm. But in your case, Jim, I'd say that paying it off as $500 a month is a good way to go.
Okay.
All right. Thanks. And good luck. Best wishes to you. That's not
Thank
so
you.
Bad. $6,000 at 5% interest, Kevin. That's not a tremendous
amount. No, it's at $25 a month in interest. No, that's not bad at all. It probably does affect their credit rating a little bit, but not carrying a balance actually can affect your credit negatively as well. I wouldn't carry a balance just to boost your credit up, but no, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah.
Again, I hope that's the worst financial difficulty they suffer in the future.
DJ in Spooner emails, I retired on June 1st, and I elected to have no federal or state taxes taken from my pension payments. Am I required to send payments before tax time? If so, how much and how often?
This is a tricky question, and it depends on the situation. I recommend people do this because if you get to the end of the year, the tax year, and then you file your taxes, and the IRS says, hey, you ended up owing us a lot of money, the IRS is like everybody else, and they like to get their money as soon as they possibly can. And if the money that you owe goes over a certain amount, and it's a fairly low threshold, they'll say to you, okay, this year you have to file quarterly estimates, and maybe you have to pay a little penalty as well on top of that. So I think it's much better off for people to generally have that money withheld, usually at about a 15% federal and 5% state level is suitable enough. And again, because interest rates are so low right now, it's not like you could earn 6 or 10% or something on that money safely while you're hanging on to a way to give to the IRS. So typically it's better off to just file it quarterly, and or else have the money withheld. And the withholding is usually for most people easier for most people to deal with.
One open line for you, and I hope time for you. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Timothy in Green Bay is next. Hello, Timothy.
Hi. I was just wondering. I know that the Social Security thing isn't a great thing to rely on, but I was wondering how to maximize your Social Security check when you do retire. I mean, what's the most you can actually, there must be a limit, and how do you do that? I mean, even if you'd had to change a job or whatever, because everybody has to pay into it, so why not try to maximize it? I don't know if that makes sense or not.
No, it definitely makes sense, Timothy, and it is a very important component for most middle-class retirees. If you live 20 years and collect, $1,500 a month, you're looking at about $300,000 or $400,000 after retirement. It's great to get a different job to earn more money, but it's more about earning the more money rather than it is about boosting your Social Security. Your Social Security is usually predicated on your 35 highest years of earnings over your work life. The easiest way to get more is to wait to take it. It'll bump up every single year until you turn 70. The problem with that, of course, is most people cleverly notice it, say, hey, wait a minute, every year I wait means I'm one more year closer to death, and then my checks will probably stop. So you have to balance that out, and most people obviously don't want to spend down all their savings while they're waiting for this two-in-the-bush version of Social Security that allegedly is going to be higher. Waiting is a good idea, but also converting some of your money before you initiate Social Security, maybe like let's say when someone retires in their late 50s, early 60s, if they're fortunate enough to do that. Converting IRAs to Roth IRAs, if you can afford to do that, allows you to mitigate the taxes you might pay on that Social Security, because distributions from Roth IRAs do not make Social Security taxable. And what you ideally would like to be at is say, hey, I've got half my liquid assets in an IRA, the other half in the Roth IRA, and now I'm going to trigger Social Security. And ideally, you'll manage your income stream enough, Timothy, where you'll pay little or no taxes at all, even though you have an income that's fairly close to what you were earning while you were working.
Thanks, Timothy, for the call. Andy in Oconomowoc is with us now. Hi, Andy.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a situation where my daughter has just been accepted into the veterinary school at UW-Madison, and she has received an inheritance from her grandfather as well, and I wonder whether we should start paying her educational expenses with the inheritance, or should we save that and get some student loans to start her educational expense?
Excuse me. First of all, congratulations, I think. Are we still congratulating people on getting accepted into veterinary school?
Yes.
Andy? Okay, good. Andy, do you feel that's worth congratulating?
Yes, I do. Okay, very proud of her.
Good for you. You should be. That's not as easy as mm-hmm. some people might think. So, and especially at that school, it's a very good veterinarian school. I would, if you don't trust yourself to hang on to the money in it, I would just use the cash from the inheritance. But otherwise, I would rather have you get whatever subsidized loans that you can, and these are typically going to be loans administered through the FAFSA plan, and then keep the savings set aside, because if for some reason the loans run out, meaning you can't get them in the future or the interest rates are too high, then you can use the savings. And in the meantime, if nothing bad like that happens, you can always use that money to help her make her loan payments, because she's, even when she's in school, then out of school, chances are she's not going to be making a ton of money right away, and so it's going to be nice to have that extra savings to help her not only pay off her loans, but also to pay for her living expenses she can't cover from her salary. So I'd rather have you use it that way and spread it out versus tapping it all out and then hoping that some other money materializes at some point in the future.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Andy. I think we have time for one more. Mary and Appleton. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I would like to go back to your technology report, if that's okay.
Sure.
I was wondering if you know whether or not any tablets will be coming out with phones incorporated into them.
That's a great question, and I barely know enough about this to know the difference between an iOS system and an Android system. There are apps out there that I'm sure many people will email in to tell us about that you can use to call through that. And even the Google one, the Nexus 7, I think has something planned for that in the future. But the problem, of course, is that you have to talk into a 10-inch tablet right now,
yeah.
And most people aren't comfortable doing that, thankfully. But no, offhand, it's a great question. I don't know, but I'm guessing we can't be too far away from that being added to it as well.
I know you can text, but I don't think you can talk just yet.
Yeah, you can get Skype on a lot of these, and if you've got a good connection, you can use Skype for either just voice calling, obviously, or better yet, video calling, and that works really well, especially with something like the tablet. Actually, it works too well when we've done that with the Apple tablet with the high resolution. I look at myself in the picture there, and I say, you know what? I think we're going to go to voice only for a while here.
Yeah, we're going to start Skyping some of our production meetings with some of our production staff in Milwaukee. I don't know if I like that or not, but we'll see.
It means that a lot of people will now have to start wearing pants to the meeting.
I know.
It's going to be a change for many of them.
No fun around here anymore. So what's the website of the week, Kevin?
Well, speaking of using your tablet computer, Hulu.com has a nice little deal right now. It's not our favorite video streaming service, but it's pretty good. Netflix is a little better, but Hulu.com is very good. And right now you can get a 2-month trial free for new users at Hulu.com. It's normally about $8 a month. And if you want to really save some money, get this, cancel your cable bill, and then you can go back on cable if you love it, or you'll save a lot more money with your entertainment. Hulu.com will have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Great. And next week, all questions answered.
Correct.
And we have time for 4 more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Back with us next week for another edition of On Your Money. If we didn't get to your question today, I hope we can get to it next week. Thanks very much to Bill Martins and to Naya Mukherjee for producing this program. Thank you for listening and for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come, including coming up tomorrow, we have our big question segment between 7 and 8. We are going to get you 2 guests from different perspectives to talk with you about President Obama's decision to relax welfare requirements, the welfare work requirements. We'll wonder if you support that or not in our big question segment tomorrow between 7 and 8. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.